Hello, and welcome to Wordland. I'm your host, David Oates. You've probably heard announcer Robin Whetstone here on WUGA. When she was in college, her interest in Russia and Russian got her a look at history.
My name is Robin Whetstone, and this is Red Ticket. In the previous chapter, I observe my surroundings on my first morning in Moscow, and I learn how seniors in Russia celebrate the winter. Today I have two chapters for you. The first is called Hussein. In America in 1993, we'd won the Cold War and had a president who played the saxophone on TV. We were on the cusp of the dot-com bubble, and on the kind of world where everyone knows what a dot-com bubble is. Everybody was drunk on victory, heading off into a golden future of Nirvana albums and internet pet stores. Journalists wrote articles about the end of history. September 11th was just a normal day. Columbine was still 6 years away. But in Russia, the ostensible loser of the Cold War, 1993, the year that I moved there, was the most brutal of the post-collapse years. The country was 2 years into Yeltsin's disastrous shock therapy approach to insta-capitalism. The Soviet state, which had meddled in the most minute details of people's lives for the past 75 years, threw up its hands and said, "Y'all are on your own now. Sorry about that." The government subsidies that had propped up food production, housing, healthcare, and education ended immediately. State control over how much things cost, which had kept prices artificially low, ceased all at once. Industries and infrastructure that had been owned by the government were instantly privatized, sold to anyone who had the money to pay. So what that meant was, whereas once the city's water treatment plant belonged to the Soviet government, now it was owned by some guy named Boris. Who were these people? Russians asked each other in 1993, as a handful of men bought up nearly all of Russia's assets. They used money and connections to become billionaires overnight, and the papers were full of their names: Berezovsky, Potanin, Malkin. The city was seized with violence as oligarchs and lesser gangsters consolidated their power and fought over their turf. I was a 22-year-old with a brand new Russian degree, so I thought I knew a lot about the country. But I didn't know any of this. That first morning in Moscow, I just knew I was hungry. I looked at the Khrushchev-era desk in my dorm room, upon which I'd arranged the items from my carry-on bag. Three spiral notebooks, three ballpoint pens, my big red Katzner's dictionary, 500 Trojan brand condoms in a mesh bag, a photograph of my mother and grandparents, vivid under the live oaks. Three small cans of tuna. That was it. I cursed the fate of the one big suitcase I'd checked on my flight, which my driver had said had disappeared. Inside of it, I had packed mostly food: ramen, peanut butter, granola bars, raisins. I'd even packed a small camping pot. I'd been to Russia before, in 1991, and knew better than to come to this country without a pot. Disappeared where, I wondered now, staring at a tuna can. There was really no telling. There was a knock on the outside door to the hallway. I opened my room door and stepped out into a small shared foyer. The room next to mine was empty. Locked. The small rooms housing the shower and the toilet sat in deep shadow, their doors half open. I padded across the foyer and opened the outside door a crack. A very short man stood in the corridor. His hands were cupped in front of him, obscuring something. "Yes," I said. He uncovered his hand and held it out to me. In his palm rested an egg. "Welcome," he said in English. He did not smile. Thank you, I said, looking from the egg to his somber face. I don't speak English, he said, in English. We switched to Russian. His name was Hussein, from Morocco. He'd brought me a hard-boiled egg as a housewarming present. Are you a student here? I asked him. Yes, he said. I study philology. Stamp collecting? I squinted at him, trying to decode the unfamiliar word. No, he said, philology. If you are in this building, you also study philology. This is Moscow State University's philology dorm. Oh, I said. Okay, philology. We stared at each other in silence. Well, he said finally, enjoy your stay. Feeling like I'd failed a test, I closed the door, went back in my room, and opened my dictionary. Philology, philology. I flipped through the pages, curious to know what I was doing in this building. There it was, philologia, the Cyrillic character spidered across the page. And next to it, the English equivalent, philology. So, I thought, enrolling in that language class means I'm a philologist, a Russian philologist. That sounded like something I'd enjoy telling people. Buoyed by this and by the gift of the egg, I returned to the window and looked down at the frozen over retaining pond. The swimmers from before were gone, the rectangle they'd cut crusting over with snow. Chapter 4, Pay Stove. I took one of the condoms out of the bag on my desk and slipped it into the pocket of my jeans. This building had 28 stories and 4 colossal wings. It was huge, the Death Star of dormitories. There had to be a place here to at least find tea. I tied my boots and stepped out into the dark hallway. Hussein's footprints were visible in the dust on the wooden floor. I followed them right across the hall to his door. Afraid to disturb him, I listened. Nothing. No sound at all. I turned away and headed down the long brown corridor. I was looking for a cafeteria or a vending machine. Anything. I turned a corner and stopped as a door ahead of me opened, and an old woman stepped out into the gloom of the corridor. She closed the door behind her quietly and walked in the opposite direction. She was holding a pot, so I followed her. I shadowed her around another corner and halfway down the next corridor, where she turned left into an open doorway. I waited a few moments and followed her in. The kitchen was a long, narrow room, lined on one side with a row of big windows that provided the only light. On the other side were 2 decrepit gas stoves. They listed together, holding each other up like drunks. A utility sink set against the back wall. The old woman stood at the sink, scrubbing her pot. She looked over her shoulder at me, startled, as I stepped in the room. "Excuse me," I said, smiling a big friendly smile. "Is there anywhere in this building to find tea?" She looked at me like she thought I might be deranged. "If you want tea, you'll have to boil water," she said. "Oh," I said, "right. Do you have a pot?" "No." I felt defensive, accused. "It's not my fault my suitcase disappeared," I wanted to say. "I brought a pot to Moscow with me. Of course I did. I'm not an idiot." "Ladna," said the old lady, "you can use mine." She stepped toward me, holding out the dented aluminum pot. I took it and moved around her to the sink. She was really quite old, I noticed. 80, maybe even older. And she was wearing an apron and slippers. What was she doing in Moscow State's dormitory? Was she a philology student too? I decided not to ask and put the pot on the burner. The stove was so lopsided that I had to hold the pot level to keep water from spilling over the lip. The knobs to turn on the gas were missing from both stoves. I tried to turn the notched metal stem where the dial controlling my burner had been, but it wouldn't move. I pressed it into the stove and tried again, still with no luck. I tried the other 3 stems and then moved to the other stove. None of them would turn. I held the pot out in front of me, staring at the stoves. "You need a Kopeck," the old woman spoke up from behind me. "Do you not have a Kopeck?" "Well, no." No pot and no kopeck. Where are you from, Diavushka? Florida, I said. Of course, she replied, satisfied. She reached into the pocket of her apron and withdrew a tiny coin. I took it from her, ashamed, and turned back to the stoves. Where do you put it in? I asked. What? She stepped up beside me, frowning. This is a pay stove? A pay stove, she cackled. Girl, give me the kopeck. She plucked the coin from my fingers and deftly inserted it into the groove in one of the stems on the front of the stove. She turned it to the right and one of the burners flared to life. It's a Russian invention, she said. A pay stove. The kopeck disappeared back into her pocket and she turned to go. What room are you in? I called out, so I can return your pot. Keep the pot. This is my gift to you. I thanked her and turned back to the stove. I held the pot level over the burner, relieved to have a project underway. Only then did I remember that I had no tea, or cup, or anything, really. I decided to forge ahead anyway. I'd worked so hard to get to this point. I looked into the water, which hadn't started boiling yet. The handle of the aluminum pot was getting uncomfortably warm. I opened and closed my fingers around the handle, shifting around the pot and trying to work my other hand under my shirt so I could use it as a pot holder. The pot wobbled on the burner, spilling half of the water and extinguishing the flame. The gas continued to hiss out. Without a kopeck, there was no way to turn it off. I remembered the night before, when I'd arrived in Moscow. In the middle of the night, unable to sleep from jet lag, I'd opened the window that took up most of one wall and sat on the sill with my legs dangling out. I sat and smoked, watching Moscow appear and disappear behind blowing sheets of snow. 23 stories below, a van crept through the empty streets, gray megaphones bristling from its roof. A cloud of noise traveled with the van, a man's voice repeating something as it progressed from street to street. When it finally passed by my building, the message floated up to me. Emergency, said the man in the van. There is a gas leak. Everyone must extinguish their cigarettes now. Is that what happened last night? I wondered now as the gas shushed out of the stove and sweetened the air around me. Some girl without a kopeck blew up a building? I opened one of the windows and went to find the old lady. Her own dusty footprints led me straight to her door. I knocked, and it was immediately opened by a boy of about 4 years old. Do you have a kopeck? I asked him. Baba! He yelled over his shoulder. The American girl wants another kopeck. Sasha, close the door! A young woman yelled back in a sharp voice. But Mom, he said, turning all the way around and letting the door swing wide open. Inside, six pairs of different-sized shoes lined a short entry hall. In the small room beyond, a young man and woman sat together on a brown couch, both of them staring at me. A card table and two folding chairs were pushed against the window, and on a corner of the bed sat the old woman, a toddler perched on her lap. Sasha! The young woman sprang to her feet. She dashed toward us, pushing the boy behind her as she backed me into the hallway. She closed the door and looked at me, breathing hard. Yes, yes, okay. She jammed her hand into her jeans pocket and yanked out a coin, which she thrust toward me. Now leave us alone. She stood in the hallway watching me as I hurried back to the kitchen. I turned off the gas, my face burning. My ineptitude had cost money for a family so desperate they had to live in a dorm room. It was humiliating for everybody. I poured the water into the sink and closed the window. I walked back down the hall the way I'd come. When I reached the family's door, closed now against the outside, I stopped and put down the pot. The kopeck stayed in my pocket. Thank you for listening to Red Ticket on WUGA's Wordland. Tune in next time to find out why I brought 500 condoms with me to Moscow. Just what am I up to, anyway?
Robin Whetstone's Red Ticket. Andrea Yuryevich's book Small Crimes is full of poetic gems.
The Book of Dreams. I fall asleep under the tremolo voice box of the moon. I fall asleep under the scratched symbol of the moon. The moon is the stone lodged in the throat of the night. The night so exiled, it wants to find its way back home. I dream about the tough heel of a walnut roll from 1975 and sharing its December bits with a clan of crows. I dream about a crow that's my imaginary older brother and a girl dance swaying her bovine hips into widowhood. I dream of sun shooting itself up between the sharp shanks of hills, down the ravine a woeful snake rent with a blunt fish knife. I dream of pouring woe into mugs and topping it with red wine. I dream the river man is parched and all I have is that wine. In a dream, I'm laying on a salamander's sleek slab inside a cave, beside a skinless drum simmering with fat carp. The fish leaping in and out of the stew are soldiers in a foxhole. In a dream, my love stirs that stew with long white oars. I have a native tongue, and I grow a foreign one too. I have a need for closed captions when I talk to people. I have no feelings about God and a chockful about men. I also have rooms filled with clocks riffing in double time. I have a longing for the coiling shadows of cypresses and a pull over the soft gray hook of the moon. I have memory drawers filled with sweet chicory root, a pull to the purple lip of the sea and its theremin breath. In a naked dream, I fall on the dock, mum is cargo. Beg the rain to drop song on the pillows of my palms. The moon slips away like a pearly soap bubble, a glistening nipple pulled from a wet mouth. I winter in that waver. My bones are oars, and within me a shady lady rose. I wake seasick from the sloshing in my veins. In another country, I'm rain.
The Book of Dreams by Andrea Yuryevich from Small Crimes. Alan Bennett was part of the satirical sketch group Beyond the Fringe with Peter Cook, Jonathan Miller, and Dudley Moore. He has skills as a serious playwright, too.
Nights in the Gardens of Spain with Penelope Wilton.
Nobody normally gets killed around here. They're mostly detached houses, and you never even hear shouting. So it took me a minute to tipple to what she was saying. I said, "Dead? Is it a heart attack?" She said, "Oh no, nothing like that. Just look at me, I'm in my bare feet." I really only know her to nod to. But they have a lovely magnolia. And once, when she was in the garden, I called out, "You've had more luck with your Magnolia grandiflora than I have." But she just smiled and said, yes. And since I didn't have another remark up my sleeve ready, that was the end of that. I do that all the time. Start a conversation and can't keep it going. Blondish woman. A bit washed out looking. Nice, tired sort of face. Anyway, she comes out into the road and waits for me to get to their gate, says, I know I don't really know you, only there's something wrong with Mr. McCorkadale. I was actually rushing, because I'd planned on getting the 5 to 9 and going into Sainsbury's, but anyway, I went in. I said, has he been poorly? She said, no. I've a feeling he's dead. Come through. Only, Mrs. Horrocks, he doesn't have any trousers on. I said, well, I do my stint at the hospice twice a week. That's not a problem. Only, to be fair, I just take the trolley round. I've never actually been there when anyone's been going, and they think I'm not really ready to administer the consolation yet. She had a nice linen dress on. Very simple. I think she might have been drinking. He was lying on his back on the rug, one of those fleecy, hairy things with blood and whatnot coming from somewhere behind his head. And it's awful. Because the first thing I thought was, well, she won't get that out. He had on some green Y-fronty things, which I would have thought were a bit young for someone who's retired. But Henry's just the same. Suddenly takes his head to go in for something a bit more dashing. Little terraline socks. I said, should I touch him? She said, you can if you want, but he is dead. I've been sitting here looking at him for an hour. I said, his pants are on back to front. She said, oh, that's me. I thought I'd better put them on before I fetch somebody in. He had a little tattoo, not far from his belly button. And I remember when they moved in, Henry said he thought he had something to do with vending machines. I said, did he bang his head, do you think? She said, oh, no. I shot him. I've put the gun away. And she opens the sideboard drawer, and there it is, with the playing cards and the table mats. He had a gun, because he'd been in Malaya, apparently. Well, my first thought was to ring Henry and ask what to do, but I couldn't face the fuss. I was still a bit nervous of calling 999 because I'm never quite sure what constitutes an emergency. Anyway, I thought, well, if she'd waited an hour already, I might as well make her a cup of tea first. And as I was running the tap, I called out, the police haven't been here already, have they? And she said, no, why? And I said, nothing. Only there were a pair of handcuffs on the draining board. The policeman had some difficulty writing. Big boy. Nice ears. Spelling all over the place. When I asked him what he thought had happened, he said, well, it's marriage, isn't it? The stresses and strains of, though we don't normally expect it with oldish people. They've generally got it out of their system by then. And it's a bit early in the day. People seem to like to get breakfast out of the way before the shooting starts. I was just signing my statement when Henry arrives back and, of course, prolongs the process. I don't know that Mrs. Horrocks quite means this, officer. What you said to me on the phone, young lady, was, I said, Henry, you weren't there. Policeman winks and says, now then, we don't want another shooting match, do we? I mean, at first, Henry didn't even know who they were. Not the Chow. I said, no, that's the Broadbents. Anyway, he sits about for a bit, whistling under his breath, and then goes upstairs and attacks his computer. When the policeman had gone, I went up and apologised and asked Henry whether he thought anything had been going on. He said, why? I said, well, she didn't have anything on under that linen dress. Of course, any suggestion of that just embarrasses Henry. He's such an innocent. He said, Rosemary, I don't know what sort of world you think you're living in, but I'm sure there's a perfectly reasonable explanation. In the meantime, let's just remember that somebody has died. I'm only sorry that you had to be the one that was passing, because I'd have preferred you not to be involved. I went out later to get some milk from the garage, and there were still one or two reporters outside number 17. And a whole branch of the magnolia broken off. One of them said, are you a neighbour? Did you know the McCorkerdales? I just shook my head and didn't say anything. So one of them shouts after me, you owe it to the community. So I turned round and I said, yes, and you owe it to the community not to break branches off people's magnolia trees. And it was just at that point when the photographer takes a picture. And it's in the paper this morning with me looking like a mad woman. And the caption, the real face of suburbia. Whereas the real face of suburbia was Henry's when he saw it. I woke up in the night and could hear him whistling. I said, are you thinking about Mrs. McCorkerdale? He said, no, I was thinking about the house. Prices are down as it is, and something like this isn't going to help matters. And he reached over from his bed and took my hand. You must try not to be upset. But unless we get at least 175, we'll have to kiss goodbye to Marbella. I keep wondering if I ought to have told somebody about the handcuffs. I'd put on my little greeny-coloured costume, which is at least tried and tested. Only when I came down, Henry said, oh, are you going in that? So I went and changed into the black. No need. It was all very casual. Policeman in his shirt sleeves, and some barrister taking me through what I'd said, scarcely interested at all. I gave her a little smile. They let her sit down most of the time. She did look pale. Pleaded not guilty, which you have to do apparently, even when they know you did it. Only then her lawyer reads out a list of stuff they'd found wrong with Mrs. McCorkerdale when she'd been arrested. Old fractures, new cigarette burns, one of her teeth loose. Another lawyer then jumps up and said, were other people involved? And she said no. And he said he wouldn't pursue that at this stage. The upshot is she was sent for trial. I said to Henry, does that mean they'll have to go through it all again? He said, oh yes. This is just the beginning. Policewoman came round this afternoon, said, Did I want any counselling? I'm entitled to it, apparently, through having seen a body. And should have had it earlier, only they had a sharabang run off the road, so they've had a bit of a backlog. Pleasant enough girl. Though she would go on about the terrible, dreadful things she'd seen. Accidents and violence and whatnot. So me, having seen just one body, seemed pretty ordinary, really. But perhaps that's part of the counselling. We sat in the garden having some tea. Heavy on the biscuits, polished off half a dozen sandwich creams. Said it was nice it was so civilised. Had I seen a naked corpse before? She was just going when she turns back and says, Mrs. Horrocks, when I went on the counselling course, one of the things they teach you is that it helps to look things in the face right from the start. I said, well, I did look at the body. I actually touched it. She said, yes. But when the police start digging, which they have to do, there is a potential for distress. I said, digging? She said, metaphorically. I said, why should it affect me? She said, well, all the indications are that it won't, but the potential is there. Things come out. I want you to know I'm here for you. I'm on a bleep. I said to Henry, it's nice she should be so concerned. He said, it's what she's there for. Unfortunately. Article in the Mail yesterday. Which I'd always thought was that bit more refined. But it was full of silly stuff about the case. What goes on behind neat privet hedges type of thing. I said to Henry, a fat lot they know. There actually isn't a privet hedge in the entire road. They're mostly beech, and one or two with cypresses Leylandii. He said he didn't think that was quite the point. And to a reporter, a hedge was merely something to be peered through. Still, talking of neat, what with her being on remand, their garden, which is usually so immaculate, is beginning to look a bit, well, shaggy. She's got a herb garden outside the back door and the borage has gone berserk, bullying its way all over the border. Made me long to nip over and put it in its place. I didn't want to ask Henry, though, as I was sure he'd think it inadvisable, Rosemary, quite candidly. But no. Turns out he's all in favour. Had in fact occurred to him, though it has to be said, coming at it from a different angle from me, saying if we were ever to get anywhere near our asking price, a garden going to seed in the same road is the last thing one wants. So, the upshot is I've started toddling up the road with my trusty secateurs. Thought I'd cut back the poppies now that they've flowered. Give the acalia a chance to come through. Of course, I've scarcely got my kneeling pad down when Miss Lumsden's out, contriving to come by with an unconvincing bottle of Lucozade en route for the bottle bank. Wants to know if there are any sweet peas going begging. I said I'd thought of picking some and taking them down to the hospice. She said, oh, what a nice idea. Some people might feel a bit funny about them, but I suppose they're all too far gone to care. And lots of jokes, of course, along the line of Mr. Pemberton's. Who do I have to shoot for you to come and do my garden? Smile got a bit fixed after a bit. Except that Sheila Blanchard did actually come in and lend a hand weeding the borders. She said she didn't blame her a bit. I mean, husbands, Rosemary. Who needs them? I said, well, they can be a comfort. She said, can they? Reggie isn't. I'm the comfort merchant. What's Henry like? Oh, I said, he's very... I said such a silly word. Very considerate. I saw her smile. And she's a nice woman. But I know it'll be all up and down the road by tomorrow. But he is considerate. Timid, I suppose. Always has been. Wish he wasn't sometimes. What I haven't told Henry is that I've dropped Mrs. McCorkadale a line to the prison, bringing her up to date on what I've been doing. I do it every day now, in fact. Even send her snaps. Told her today I was keeping an eye on the Alcamilla mollis. Lovely plant, but you have to read it the Riot Act occasionally. She rang this afternoon to thank me. I didn't know you could do that from prison. Ring up. Her name's Fran. Dear Fran. I've misjudged Henry. Got him all wrong. 30 years of marriage and you think you've got someone all weighed up, but no. He's lost half a stone. Since the case has been going on, never set foot in the office. I thought, well, you're a better person than ever I thought you were. I said to Fran, he's more worried about you than he's ever been about me. I mean, the day I had my scan, he went off to a golf tournament. So, as a reward, I got out the brochures for Marbella. That seemed to cheer him up. It's all come out in court, though. Turns out that Mr. led her a dog's life, literally. The defence produced a collar and lead in evidence. Beat her. Terrorised her. A saga of protracted and imaginative cruelty, counsel said. Of course, the prosecution goes after her, claiming it was all part of some game, sexually speaking, and that the cruelty was what she wanted. But she said, if it had been mutual, he wouldn't have been interested. Anyway, how is it mutual to have your arm broken? Lots of lurid details. How sometimes he'd put a hood over her head so she couldn't see and bring in other people to watch. Business associates, she thought. Leading lights from the world of vending machines, probably. Henry said she was lucky because there was another case going on the same week up in Liverpool. A man had up for killing a child. So that pushed her out of the limelight a bit. Of course, what Henry calls the wild and woolly feminist ladies were out in force, even calling from the gallery. To a degree irresponsible, Henry said. However mitigating the circumstances, Rosemary, she must be looking at a custodial sentence. So, when he only gave her 2 years, the judge got it from the law and order people. But as Sheila Blanchard said, worth every minute of it, dear, if you ask me. Couple of years basket weaving, and you get the bed to yourself. Cheap at the price, just wish I had a gun. As it is, I'm pinning my hopes on his prostate. I can't go and see her so often now she's convicted. And Henry doesn't know I go at all. Well, I've never had a best friend before. The sort you can tell everything to. Never had one. Never been one. Not even when I was a girl. Not the type, I suppose. And no secrets to tell anyway. And with not having children, I was never a member of that club either. She's in Rissington, the other side of York. It's one of those modern places. Looks like a business park. Or an out-of-town shopping centre. Crimes are us. She's transformed the prison garden, which used to be very utilitarian, cabbages and lettuces and whatnot. But now she's got them to do some interplanting, even make a bit of a potager. And while it'll never be Sissinghurst, well, the site's too windy. It's streets ahead of what it was. She has visions of it being open to the public. But that's difficult with it being a prison. We go and sit on a seat in the garden. And she started telling me all about the things he forced her to do. Said she wanted me to know, in case it made me not want to see her anymore. I said, don't be silly. But terrible things. I never knew people did. And with a hood over her head, and men there, watching in silence. More than watching, actually. One of them, who had a funny habit, and I knew what she was going to say the second before she said it. A funny habit of whistling under his breath. Of course, a lot of people do that. I see they're selling the murder house, Sheila Blanchard calls out to me this morning. The board's gone up, asking 160. I didn't say I knew. Or that actually it's sold already. Fran says they're an Asian family. Quite well to do. Own a chain of electrical shops. I thought, well, that won't do Marbella any good. Golf with Jimmy Tarbuck takes a knock. I look at him a lot now. This once-upon-a-time spectator. Or maybe still, who knows? Somewhere. And I think, well, sometimes I just think, you dark horse. Other times I think about Fran and get upset. He caught me staring at him the other night, said, what are you looking at, young lady? I said predictably, nothing. You've been getting a bit broody lately, he said. And he patted me on the knee. What I was actually thinking was whether all these years he'd been wanting to see me crawl around the room naked on my hands and knees. No worse than bedding out, I suppose. Though if I did it nowadays, I'd have to have my knee pads on. Might take the edge off it a bit. But I think about the collar and lead. Then I think, well, that's what my marriage has been like too. Being jerked along. I mean, what else is Marbella? We never settled on what to call it. That was part of the trouble. The gardens made me quite used to things having a common name and a Latin one. But with sex, neither seemed to suit Henry. Not coming from me anyway, just got embarrassed. He's no idea I go and see her. I tell him it's the hospice. The farm goes from strength to strength. She's gone commercial with her tomatoes and put her onions in for shows. She's there every free moment. Well, I say free. Except when I say goodbye at the gate, I feel it's me that's going back to prison. Once a month, they let her out for half a day. And we go off for the afternoon and do all sorts. Open gardens, obviously, auctions we've been to, car boot sales, and old churches, which I've never cared much for. But Fran knows all about them. One church in the middle of a field, near to where there'd been a battle. And we sit there in the pew, and she explains all the architectural features. And sometimes I think, I've never been so happy in all my life. She took my arm this last time, just as we were coming down the steps at Fountains Abbey. And when we got to the bottom, she didn't let go. It was just like it was when I was a girl and when a boy did it. Such a bold step and so meant. And I thought, here I am, strolling arm in arm with someone who's murdered her husband. And I said out loud, I know what this is. And she said, what is it? And I said, it's life. She wasn't feeling too clever today, so we just went and sat in the grounds, and she took my arm again. Going into York next week for a checkup. Thought I might just go and hang around the hospital. On the off chance I might see her. But she'll be with a warder, apparently, so I won't. I've never had to start a garden from scratch before. There are no features at all. Flat, square, stony. It's like one of the before pictures in the gardening magazines. Or an exercise yard. A lawn's pretty much out of the question in this heat, and the water supply's very quixotic. though Henry says the greens at the golf club are immaculate. And he saw Sean Connery last week. So I sit and look at it and draw plans. Look on it as a challenge, Henry says. You'll crack it, young lady, he says, I know you. She died, did Fran? Lot of to-ing and fro-ing before they eventually tracked it down. No surprise to either of us. Doctors. It's the first thing that occurs to you and the last thing that occurs to them. By which time it's too late. Oh, it was always too late, Mrs. Horrocks. She was in a hospice at the finish, so I knew the drill. I used to hold her hand, kiss it. She'd kiss mine. We talked about a little garden centre. Best thing that could have happened, Henry said. Which is when I should have packed my bags. Instead, I just went and sat in the greenhouse for a bit. Typical. He'll sometimes wear one of those caps with big peaks that boys wear. Reckons it's for the sun. Caught him the other day wearing it back to front. Suppose it's known as a new lease of life. There's supposed to be a lot of criminals round here. Bank robbers and such like, who can't go back, so play golf all day. Of course, it's just what would happen in a play. Fran shot him, so she had to pay. Only this place is crawling with people who haven't paid. Unless you account just being here as paying. The gardening books talk about plants that are supposed to like shade. They say they prefer it. I don't believe it. I don't believe anything like shade. Oh, they do perfectly well in the shade, it's true. But give them a bit of sun, and suddenly they come into their own. I sit here at night, listening to the frogs and the crickets. And Henry, whistling under his breath.
Alan Bennett's from his collection Talking Heads 2. I'm currently assembling another collection of haiku and senyu. Here are a few candidates. Winter dusk, finding the glasses I wear to look for my glasses. Liquor store not open, he shifts from foot to foot in the winter wind. Rain on the roof, yet he plays his recording of Rain on the Roof. Falling into rhythm, an artillery loader and his targets. A border people once died for, not even a sign. Alzheimer's, goodbye hug, goodbye hug. Same last name, a black southerner and a white. I reach for my fork. He says, shall we say a blessing? When she overhears the president criticized, I'm not a racist. Moving into the dorm, her mom follows with a little fridge on a cart. Parent chaperones, dry brown flowers in the blueberry box. This was collected in a local coffee house, eavesdropping on a band that was splitting up. Authorship, you played the bass line that I wrote. 30 years married, an in-season cantaloupe, perfectly ripe. Some of my micro-poetry. That's our show. So this is David Oates saying goodbye, and thanks for listening to Wordland. Wordland is a Monkey Sound production recorded in the studios of WUGA. If you have questions or comments, please call your radio station or send email to dvdoates@aol.com. That's dvdoates@aol.com. Thank you.